I want to welcome you again. I hope you've enjoyed your meal and will continue to do so. As some of you may know, the Independent Institute doesn't hold annual dinners. We actually only hold these kinds of events from time to time. And we do so when we feel there's someone whose work and effort we feel is truly noteworthy and worthy of celebrating. As I mentioned earlier, we believe that Bob Galvin fits this criteria to a T. He's labored for decades as a technology pioneer, an entrepreneur, and much more on a global basis. And we're particularly pleased to have the opportunity to recognize actually just some of his achievements. Joining Bob this evening is another entrepreneur who is quite early demonstrating many of the same characteristics. A businessman, a scholar, firmly rooted in principles, who's making major waves in quite a number of fields. Our first speaker tonight is Peter Thiel, who's founder and managing member of Clarium Capital Management, a global macro hedge fund. The fund has been profiled in Barron's, the Financial Times, an Institutional Investor, and Peter's commentary on the markets is regularly featured on programs like Kudlow and Cramer, Your World with Neil Cavuto. Although still shy of 40, in fact, well shy of 40, Peter has already had a deep and varied career in finance, including derivatives trading for Credit Suisse Financial Products in New York and London, and securities law practice at Sullivan and Cromwell, one of New York's most prominent business law firms. But Peter is perhaps best known for co-founding PayPal in 1997. Within just a few years, he established PayPal as the world's preeminent electronic payment services provider and distinguished PayPal as one of the few internet firms to achieve profitability, selling it to eBay in 2002 for $1.5 billion. Peter received his BS and JD from Stanford University and sits on the board of visitors of the Stanford Law School, as well as on the board of directors of the Independent Institute. I first had the pleasure of working closely with Peter when he co-authored the Independent Institute's book critiquing political correctness in higher education, entitled The Diversity Myth. He continues to apply his analytical mind to a variety of interests, and I'm very pleased to present Peter Thiel.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, David, for that incredibly gracious introduction. I feel like anything I say is going to be an incredible letdown after that, and I must confess that I always feel a bit intimidated being in front of a group as distinguished as all of you are who are here tonight. And one of the things that's so difficult is I'm always asked to sort of tell people lessons about things that we learned from PayPal or lessons about being an entrepreneur or an innovator or the global marketplace. It's actually very difficult to abstract. The reality is that each of these companies are very unique. You can't actually necessarily apply that much from them. I'm going to say a few things that are a little bit more general in nature. I thought it would be helpful maybe just to start by telling the particular story of PayPal, how we built the company, how we started it. We may have been brilliant, we may have been very lucky, perhaps it was a combination of the two. The company was started, as David mentioned, in the late 90s by myself and another friend of mine. We recruited a number of our college friends at the point where I was the only person of the founding team who was over 23 years old. Everybody else was not aware of things that they weren't allowed to do or couldn't do, and so we set out to create a new world currency, or as we more modestly like to describe it, an operating a financial operating system for the world. And for those of you, some of you may be familiar with the PayPal product, some of you may not be. The basic idea was to link money and email. And it was a very simple idea. It was basically you could send money to anybody with an email address. And it seemed like a pure product that was designed for the pure internet world of 1999. Money is the ultimate virtual product. You don't need to have a storefront or anything like that. All you needed were some great web designers, some top-notch engineers. You needed to get a website up, and then people could start sending money from one person to the next anywhere in the world. We concluded that because we weren't old enough, nobody else would take us seriously. So we had to figure out a way to launch the product without working with big companies, without working with banks or telephone operators or anything like that. And so we had to somehow get a grassroots adoption of the product to start. And we created what's called in the industry lingo viral product, where as people use the product, they'd get other people to use it. And it was very simple. You'd register with the product, you'd give us your credit card number, you typed in the email address of the person to whom you wish to send money, and then the recipient would get an email saying, you've got cash. And at that point, the recipient would have every incentive to sign up. And as a result, you could start with a small number of people, and you could gradually grow the product as people send money to one another for various reasons. We also concluded that just to help the process along, we'd pay people up front to get them to sign up. We'd give you $10. We give you $10 if you signed up, and we gave you $10 for everybody you refer to. It cost us $20 to acquire each customer, and while it felt like an insane thing to do, and there were all sorts of concerns about there being adverse selection, and you just were selecting for people who only wanted to get paid free money, it was actually cheaper than all the other sort of advertising type opportunities that were available. The product was launched in October of 1999. At the time, the company had 24 people, and we basically started with those people emailing money to their friends, to their acquaintances, and then it started to grow with this very smooth exponential curve where the user numbers, at first it was a very small number, but it was basically compounding at about 5 to 7% per day. And if you do the math, that it grows pretty quickly. And so it was by mid-November, we were up to 1,000 people. By December 31st of 1999, it was up to 12,000. By February 2nd of 2000, it was up to 100,000. By mid-April of 2000, it was up to 1,000,000. It was this smooth quasi-exponential curve. It turned out, actually, that people found it to be very useful in a lot of contexts, especially among small businesses that needed to receive payments from other people where all they knew was their email address, and it was a way for people selling, people who were micro merchants, in particular on eBay, which subsequently bought the company, to buy and sell things from one another. The company, incidentally, has kept scaling and scaling. Currently, there are about 46 million people worldwide using the PayPal service. It's available in about 38 different countries, so it continued to grow and grow. But the initial stage was this pure cascading growth trajectory. And looking at it in early 2000, the thought really was, you know, this product is going to literally take over the whole world. And we're going to replace every government in the world. We're going to replace all the finance, this is going to be the new currency. It is going to it's growing so quickly. You know, by the end of the year, we will have more or less taken over the whole planet. And there was a talk I gave almost exactly 4 years ago at the financial crypto conference in Anguilla, where there's sort of these libertarian and anarchist type people, and they've been trying to come up with this new digital payment, digital currency type idea that would be free from all sorts of government constraints, and they've been working on it for, you know, 7-8 years. By early 2000, there were people giving theoretical papers on why this could never be done. And when Max, my co-founder, and I arrived and announced that we'd figured it out, there were a number of people who were not too happy, the goal was to try to build something like this, and it scaled. I would say there was a transition point, and sort of in the spring of 2000, we had, you could say, a rendezvous with reality or with politics or with the way the world really works, but perhaps the way the world really works and really shouldn't work, or something like that. The first part, of course, was that there were some basic things at the margins that started to break down. It turned out we had customers, and you needed to do something with all these customers. And so they were calling in nonstop on the company phone lines. By April of 2000, you could not use any of the telephones in the office without. If you picked up a phone, there was a customer calling in. You had to basically use your you could only use cell phones at the office. It grew far beyond anybody's expectations. It was so successful. But on a more sinister level, what we next encountered were Russian mobsters who were interested in figuring out ways to steal money. And there were all sorts of variations on this. But the standard variation was that a mobster would break into an unsecured database and steal 1,000 people's identity. So they'd steal your name, your credit card number, your social security number, all that stuff. They'd set up 1,000 different PayPal accounts in those people's names, and they'd charge each of those people, say, $500, and collect $500,000 in their account. And from there, it would get wired to the Bank of New York, and from there to Kazakhstan. And we had this long race with the Russian mob in terms of how do we stop these people. And it was one of the core technology innovations we developed in 2000 was to develop a powerful anti-fraud technology that could actually stop all this fraud from happening. And you know, sort of a lot of rather colorful stories. I remember my mother was accosted by this guy Igor Yagolnitzer at a local chess club, and it took me about a year later to figure out that our anti-fraud technology, which was named Igor, was named after this person. He threatened my mother with that if he didn't get his money out of PayPal because we'd frozen his account, he was going to report us to the police. It turned out, and then of course, so we solved that problem. Business continued to scale very nicely. But probably the biggest challenge that we ran into as entrepreneurs was the government regulatory apparatus. And this was certainly the thing that I perhaps would have least expected. But in a sense that it failed in anything positive that one might have expected, and then of course all sorts of negative things. So the positive place where it failed was in providing security. The natural thing was there are people defrauding you. You think you can go to the police. So you know maybe Mr. Yagolnitzer is not going to go to the police, but maybe we can go to the police and report Mr. Yagolnitzer. We proceeded to do that. The FBI showed up at his home, concluded you know he was totally innocent. We'd given them web pages. They were asking us what's a banner ad. There was a jurisdictional dispute between the FBI office in San Jose and San Francisco over which of them had jurisdiction over Kazakhstan and could handle it. So there were some very serious sorts of problems. So on the positive side, if we had not come up with a technology solution to fraud, we would have simply gone out of business. They might have arrested various low-level people, but we never would have gotten the money back. On the more critical side, the kinds of issues one ran into were incredibly arcane, unworkable banking rules. Rules about payment systems, rules about as David mentioned, I'd been trained as a lawyer, and I guess I'd been ideologically fairly libertarian before starting the company, but I sort of became completely fanatical in this process. By the end of PayPal, by early 2002, we were spending about $500,000 a month in legal fees to deal with all the various regulatory pressures. The company was doing well. It made in 2002 about $200 million in revenues, $35 million profits, but $500,000 a month. There were 20 different law firms on the payroll, and it was patent lawyers, banking lawyers, antitrust lawyers, labor lawyers, immigration lawyers. You had payments lawyers as distinct from banking lawyers. And you had various patent intellectual property things, and so on down the line. It was a really, really extraordinary sort of a situation. The company you know, as to make the long story short, the company did not end up taking over the world in quite the way we had originally envisioned. It was still, by many measures, a great success. Had a very successful IPO in early 2002, and was acquired by eBay in October of 2002 for $1.5 billion. As we basically were, in effect the cash registers on eBay. That about two-thirds of our volume was on eBay, and about two-thirds of the people on eBay were using PayPal. Now, I'm very happy that in the title for your talk tonight, you had nothing about the government or ways in which the government can help entrepreneurship or innovation or the global marketplace, because I do think that one of the lessons is that on every single level, I think there's never been an innovative idea the government did not like. The craziest version of this that I have to recount in the PayPal context was on the banking regulatory side. In the middle of the IPO, I'll give you the full chronology since it was so crazy. A Business Week article said, great company, but nobody knows whether they're subject to banking rules. And there are four states that have not decided, and there was California, New York, and Idaho, and the state of Louisiana. And there was a mid-level banking bureaucrat in Louisiana who said, I don't really know what they're doing, but if they're doing illegal banking, they have to stop. And at that point, the SEC commissioner, and we sort of got, we drew, unfortunately, a very short straw in picking our SEC regulator and going through the IPO process. He was scanning the internet for stories about PayPal because he had concluded that all companies in the U.S. were run by crooks, and it was his duty to prevent all the companies from having IPOs, and he was going to stop us from doing it no matter how he could. And he basically, and so he proactively called up the people in Louisiana and said, well, are you working to shut them down? And they were intimidated by this call from someone in D.C. and said, yes, we'll probably do that. And a few days later, when we talked to the SEC, they announced, well, what are you doing about, have you disclosed in your document that you're being shut down in Louisiana? And we said, well, that's news to us. But he said, well, I have the facts right here. I'll send it to you. And then at that process, I basically got on the phone and tried to track down the banking commissioner in Louisiana in the middle of Mardi Gras, and I think it was one of the reasons the single most successful achievement I had at PayPal was I managed to track the banking commissioner of Louisiana down in the middle of Mardi Gras, and convince him that you know, perhaps this was not a wise step for Louisiana and they did not want to get a reputation as a technologically backward state. But at any rate. You know, when one steps back and thinks about stories like PayPal's story, when one thinks about the whole new economy, I think there were a lot of mistakes that were made. There were a lot of people who were naive and idealistic and who built businesses that ultimately did not succeed. I think that needs to be conceded. All of that happened. At the same time, I really believe that this was the right way to go. It was, we are headed towards a global economy. PayPal was critical towards that in terms of creating a seamless way for people to move money around the world. We're headed towards a global marketplace, and I think the only way that a global economy can ultimately work is based on free trade, the free exchange of different people, and so on down the line. If you don't think of it in economic or free market terms, but if you think of it in political terms, you run into nothing but paradoxes. And it seems to me that the fundamental paradox about globalization is that on a political level, what we see happening is the entire world, the entire human community, is in some sense being networked, being grouped together, but of course it is not at all unified. There's no sense in which everybody on the world is the same. The reality is that people are very different, they don't agree, and it's not possible to get political agreement for different people. And because of that, I think the only way that the world can become unified in some sense is through technology. Technology is driving us towards a single seamless humanity. But it is, but it's not possible to reach that by political means. And in fact, if anything, everything that counts as political, it represents a counterpoint to that. One of the definitions of politics that I've come to believe is very true is that politics is fundamentally, the way politics fundamentally achieves unity is by identifying a collective enemy. And while it always sounds very reductionist when you frame it that way, I think there's a disturbing amount of truth to it, so that, you know, the British really didn't discover they were British until the 14th century, when they discovered that they were the French people whom they really hated. And before that time, they'd all been Angles and Saxons and Normans, and they all hated each other. And and so on down the line. I think that the reality of human nature is that people are unique, they're different, they're individuals, and because of that, it's not possible to achieve any kind of fictitious political unity around a positive good. It's only possible to achieve unity around negative goods, around collective enemies, external enemies, and things like that. Now, the paradox is that this could work in a tribal context. It was maybe not just, it was maybe wrong in a lot of ways, but it could sort of work in some kind of very narrow sense. It can never work in a global context, because when you're talking about the entire planet, there is no outside left. I'm assuming we're not going to have an invasion by aliens from outer space, because that's probably the one way you could achieve political unity. You could have peace on Earth by starting an interplanetary war. That's not an option. For one thing, I don't think the aliens will arrive in time to save us from ourselves. For another, I think that's not the reality that we're dealing with on some level. And so what you see instead is this very fundamental conflict. If you look at organizations like the United Nations that are designed to achieve some kind of world political system, people always say, well, they're so ineffective, they do so little. And I would say the reality is that no global open global political organization can achieve anything when it has to unite against outsiders, and on a global basis, there are no outsiders. That's the fundamental paradox of the global economy. It is radically incompatible with politics. And that's why I believe that as technology progresses in the 21st century, and as we continue to see the globalization of the world economy, we will come to see government more and more as a reactionary force, as a force that is standing in the way of progress. And we will have to take a very drastic choice. You know, I think the world, the current system is not stable, where we have this weird hybrid of trying to preserve political regimes in which people are defined by an us versus them, insider versus outsider mentality, with a global marketplace in which you're trying to figure out a way for everybody to be able to get along with everybody else on the planet. You can't have both. You have to choose between politics and between sort of the hidden motor of Western civilization, which in some sense is being driven most clearly by technology. That's a very fundamental choice. We know that the way of politics and government and things like that lies sort of murder and madness. And that's a sense in which government is something that's, I think, almost literally demonic in the world we're living in today. It's not an option. We must go the other way. I think most people are. I'll end on a very libertarian note. I don't believe that there's any sort of anything about this that is historically predestined in one way or another. I think it's up to individuals to choose which of the two they want. And I would encourage people to choose. To choose entrepreneurship, to choose innovation, to choose the global marketplace, and choose the authentic vision that the new economy, I believe, encapsulated very well. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Peter. At the Independent Institute's Conference Center in Oakland, we hold many events on different policy issues. Several years ago, before PayPal, Peter gave a talk with another economist, his name is Richard Rahn, on virtual money. And at that time, he had a firm called Confinity, which was merged, and that's part of what PayPal came from. But it's interesting going back and reading that transcript and what's happened since.